If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think, I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shack of the sauce bottle, mate.
Welcome to Democracy Sausage with me, Mark Kenny. This podcast, as you know, comes from the ANU each week, and we discuss politics, international and national politics, and all kinds of other things. Pretty much got a roving brief. And this week we're talking to Dr. Charles Miller. Now, Charles Miller has been on the podcast a few times now. We've spoken a lot about Ukraine and sort of other security matters. He's a senior lecturer in the School of Politics and International Relations here at the ANU and has a very international focus. As I say, specialises in defence and security and international relations matters, keeps a weather eye on a whole lot of things. And of course, there's a fair bit going on in that tortured space. Mm. We've spoken a lot about Gaza and what's happening there. Let's start off, though, here, Charles, with Ukraine, because this is, to borrow a term that's been used once or twice in history, almost a forgotten war. That's probably an exaggeration, of course. It still gets plenty of attention, but it has been overshadowed by the horrors of Gaza over the last several months. And it does appear to be entering a very difficult stage.
Yes.
There are signs that that the West and European countries, but the West, particularly led by America and the American public, are losing their kind of appetite for making sacrifices to fight this war. And, of course, there's all that domestic stuff we know about Trump. We can talk about that in a minute. But I wonder if you could give me your sense of where you think things are at with Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think we are indeed in a fairly dangerous phase from the point of view of Ukraine and the international community. So last Northern Hemisphere summer, Ukraine mounted a counteroffensive, which was widely heralded. There were high hopes.
Perhaps too widely heralded.
Perhaps, yes, yes. Yeah. I think that, yes, I do think in retrospect that a lot of people who support Ukraine should have been a lot more careful in building up expectations for what it could do. But nonetheless, I mean, I think that the offensive is now widely judged to have been a failure. It was unable to make really significant ground against the Russians.
And this was, just to sort of dwell on that point for a moment, this was because in the end it turned out, I mean, it's sort of, as I have made this comparison, a number of others have as well, it sort of started to mimic the First World War in a sense. It had that kind of feeling of the Western Front. You had, it almost became this very slow grind, taking very small amounts of territory, arduous, fixed positions by both sides. But it was overlaid by high-tech aerial surveillance, which made it very difficult for the advancing Ukrainians to actually advance. They put their tanks forward, and those tanks were suddenly exposed to enemy fire because the enemy knew where they were even before Ukraine could adjust its artillery cover.
Well, I mean, it's incredibly difficult, really, to make very much ground in this kind of in this kind of war, especially if, as in the case of Ukraine, you don't have air superiority. So if you've got air superiority, what you can do is you can prevent the defensive forces from massing against you in the rear, what's called the deep battle or the deep area. So essentially, if the Ukrainians were to make a sort of small breakthrough, for instance, in the line against the Russians, if the Ukrainians had air superiority, they could prevent the Russians from massing to counterattack. But because they don't have that, they can't do it. And so essentially what the Ukrainians were being asked to do in some ways was to mount a type of warfare that a Western army usually would attempt to wage, but the Western army would usually be fairly assured of having aerial superiority. And so therefore, this made things very difficult. Another problem is the fact that a large proportion of the Ukrainian army had not been trained enough. I remember, I think when you were talking last, you said, you know, why was the Ukrainian offensive delayed so much? Well, in actual fact, it probably should have been delayed a little longer. Because, you know, you had Ukrainian troops that were going through courses of training that were below what the minimum would have been expected for Allied troops in World War II, for example.
Wow.
And you also had an inability, or rather, you had a lack of maneuvers at a relatively high level. So maneuvers at divisional core level, for example, the Ukrainians had not practiced these things. So therefore, they're not able to kind of coordinate at a relatively high level on the battlefield. And so for all of these reasons, really, the counteroffensive was unsuccessful. And what it leaves Ukraine now with the problem of doing is that they have now a manpower shortage. And so what they will have to do, if they are to be able to go back onto the offensive, is they'll have to give it even more time. So they'll have to be able to somehow get through 2024, stand up a new number of units, train them properly in order to be able to take the offensive again in 2025, if they can do that. And this is kind of the problem now, because US aid to Ukraine is trickling off, obviously, because of opposition in Congress. European aid, which the Europeans had been planning to provide, is not due, even under optimistic scenarios, to come really online in a serious way until 2025. So essentially now they have to
And when you say European aid, you mean European aid of arms and ammunition?
Yes,
in particular,
on a large scale. Yeah. Right. So obviously there is still European aid coming through to Ukraine right now, but we're talking a vastly scaled up effort that would potentially be able to replace what they were getting from the United States. That level of aid is something that is scheduled to be provided in 2025. And again, the thing is, you know,
this is about manufacturing capacity, isn't it? Because Europe has been basically, if you go by a lot of the seems to me quite legitimate criticism of Europe over basically three decades since the end of the Cold War, is that Europe has been sort of cruising on this assumption that the kind of peace is the normal state of affairs.
Yes.
Putin may have been thinking precisely along opposite lines, certainly recently, preparing for war, arguably. Mm-hmm. And so Europe just doesn't literally have the manufacturing capacity to meet the demands of a hot war.
Well, it needs to step up those capacities. And I think there's a deeper problem as well, however, and it's a problem that's gone back. I mean, it's a problem that was first identified in the Cold War by two economists, Manker Olson and Richard Zeckhauser, who talked about the economic theory of alliances. And this is basically where the whole idea of alliance free riding comes from, is the idea that Europe by itself is a collection of, it's still really effectively a collection of independent countries when it comes to defense, security, and foreign policy. Some of those countries are a little bit bigger than others, like Germany, but a lot of them are relatively small. And the problem is that in order to defend all of Europe, well, this is what economists would call public good that needs to be provided for the entire continent. However, each individual country has an incentive to let another individual country pick up the slack. Mm. This is the problem. And so therefore, if it were up to Europe by itself, the pessimistic view is that they won't be able to coordinate. And this is really regardless of whether, this is even if they considered there to be a really serious security threat. So the role of the United States historically, I mean, since World War II in this, what was termed, I'm not sure if Olson and Zeckhauser themselves used this term, but it is what's termed the hegemon. So the hegemon basically is a country which is much bigger than all of the other countries in the alliance, which can therefore make a really serious dent in the problem that can basically provide this public good for the rest of the alliance and therefore ensure that Europe is properly defended, okay? Now, the problem for the United States in that kind of setup is that then obviously it exacerbates the free rider problem because the United States has provided this public good of defense and therefore the European countries have even less incentive to provide it for themselves.
And this is where, and one hesitates to say this very often, but this is where Trump...
Well, I think we got, what, about 10 minutes in before we...
I was going to say something controversial, which is this is where Trump is right in the sense that, you know, he's... You know, he may prosecute these arguments in his particular way and it's all very explosive and everything else and destructive. But he's really picked up this idea that basically the US has been paying for Europe's defense, underwriting Europe's security for a long time. And, you know, he's called them free riders. And we saw that amazing circumstance several weeks back where he was basically saying, I mean, he was explicitly said that he had told one of the European leaders, if you don't pay your way, I hope Putin has his evil way with you. I mean,
I'll tell him to do whatever the hell he likes.
Yeah.
Right? Now, that is one way to look at it. But what I think is often missed in the way that people talk about this issue is the fact that it is actually paradoxically in America's interests to be exploited in this way. It is in America's interest for people to free ride on it. And let me explain why that is the case. So what Olson and Zeckhauser would say in their setup is that if the United States were somehow not involved in European security, the Europeans would not be able to solve the free rider problem for themselves. So everybody would under-contribute and Europe would not have... a sufficient level of security, essentially. So, just to pick that apart a bit,
does that mean that the suggestion is that it would fall to France and Germany in particular, and there would be competition between them to see which one of them carried more of the cost?
Which one carried less of the cost?
Yeah, well. We mean the same thing, but the way you put it is better. They would be hoping the other one carried the majority of the cost.
Yes, that's right.
And underneath them would be the smaller economies and they'd be just leaving it to the bigger ones. And
yes, exactly.
The net result is there wouldn't be enough put into it.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, so if you look at it from this perspective, this is the way I often try and explain it. If you're, say, for example, the Prime Minister of Denmark, right? So if you increase your defense spending to 2.5% of GDP, how many soldiers, tanks, aircraft, et cetera, does that actually mean for NATO? Not that many. Certainly not enough to make a serious difference in the defense of Europe against the Russians. Germany, maybe it's a little bit more. But the United States, however, the United States spends 2.5% of its GDP on defense. That's a really big, substantive chunk of Europe's defense taken care of right there. However, from the point of view of the Danish Prime Minister, 2.5% of GDP on defense means that that's money that they cannot spend then on social welfare programs, health, education, or alternatively money that they can't give back to the Danish people in the form of tax cuts. So the costs, proportionately speaking, for the Prime Minister of Denmark are the same as those for the President of the United States. It's just that the marginal contribution that the Prime Minister of Denmark can make to overall European security is much smaller than the United States. So even if you assume that both the Danes and the Americans care equally, or even if you assume that the Danes care a little bit more, it's still in the interest of the Danes not to provide the good, essentially, which is a higher level of defense spending and defense capability. So what Olson and Zeckhauser would probably say is that if the United States withdrew, it would cause the Europeans to panic an awful lot, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it would cause them to step up. What would be more likely to happen would be it just the good, if you like, the defense would just not be provided at all. And the reason why that would be bad for the United States would be, well, then Europe is essentially defenseless and in the stage of the Cold War. Maybe not perhaps quite so true now, but then the Soviet Union would have been able to overrun Western Europe and you're facing a essentially unified Eurasian continent all dominated by communism. So it was in the interest of the United States, certainly during the Cold War, to provide this security for Europe, even though they were being exploited by the Europeans, as opposed to withdrawing completely, in which case the Europeans will just not provide defense at all. So that's kind of the that's kind of the dilemma. And so when American presidents then say, look, you know, Europeans need to spend more, they need to step up. And they say this obviously about Asian allies as well. You need to step up, you need to pay more, et cetera, et cetera. The reason why it doesn't work is because it's just not credible that the United States would actually withdraw this protection, because that would hurt them as well. Well, it would hurt them more than actually
But what you've just put forward with respect is a sophisticated argument.
Yeah.
Donald Trump shows no capacity for absorbing sophisticated arguments or even for reading them to begin with.
Right, exactly.
I mean, literally, he doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean,
people
close to him, I've listened to Scaramucci and others talking about his absolute aversion to brief any longer than you know, three or four pars.
Right.
He's got all of these prejudices. He's got a very good instinct for you know, sort of the populist easy line, and that's his position. So he has talked about pulling out of NATO.
Right.
These, you know, I think we need to start. The world needs to start taking Trump more seriously
in terms of what he's saying.
No,
I agree. What I'm talking about is how pretty much every U.S. president since Harry Truman has thought about NATO and alliance burden sharing. They'll complain about it. They wish the Europeans would spend more, but ultimately they, as they conceive of America's interests are to provide the security of Europe, even if it means that the Europeans free ride on them to a certain degree. Okay.
Doctrinally, they've always been
happier
to have their defense carried out elsewhere as well, like offshore.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Donald Trump is different. I agree. Donald Trump doesn't believe that it's in the US's interests to protect Europe, basically. As far as I can tell, he does not believe this in the slightest. Whether he believes it about Asia, again, not sure, to be honest. I mean, you know, as a mutual friend of ours was saying, you know, it really kind of depends what he ate for breakfast this morning what he believes on a lot of things.
Which is probably a hamburger. But
yes. Well, exactly.
Coke.
Right. Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah. He's a giant adolescent.
Yes, essentially, yes. So if he, you know, so if that's what he believes, and then the United States does withdraw from Europe, one possibility is that the European countries will step up, and I hope that they do, and I think that they should, and I think
there are some signs of this.
There are some signs of them doing this, yes. But the other alternative is that they just don't. They just keep on arguing over who's going to provide X or Y or Z, and nothing happens, and then we're in a very dangerous situation, because right now, I would personally argue that the biggest obstacle, if Ukraine were taken out of the picture, the biggest obstacle facing Vladimir Putin between where he currently is and the Atlantic Ocean is the Polish army.
Mm.
Poland is the strongest military power in continental Europe. Certainly has the most will to fight, certainly is doing the most to build up its military. The Bundeswehr has been really badly drawn down since the end of the Cold War. It was a formidable fighting force during the Cold War. It no longer is. The British and French militaries have been optimized for counterinsurgency since 9/11, which means that they've drawn down an awful lot of their conventional warfighting capabilities. And the British Army, certainly I know the British Army, the understanding is that they are really seriously outgunned by the Russians right now. So if they were to go into the field against the Russians, even what the British have got, they're seriously outgunned. And I think that the same is probably true for the French as well. So really, you know, Poland is the major obstacle. The Western forces, the NATO forces in the Baltics are relatively small. They're essentially a tripwire force. So they're there to kind of convince the Russians that the West would join a wider war if they were to invade the Baltics. So it is a dangerous situation. Now, maybe Vladimir Putin wouldn't want to invade Poland or wouldn't want to invade the Baltics. Maybe he doesn't think that Russia has got enough left in the tank for that. But if he did want to, he'd have a fairly good chance of success, especially the Baltics, because we're talking really, really small areas. I mean, I don't know how it would be in the Australian context, but imagine Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia's, you know, like Tasmania-sized place, maybe even smaller than that. And it's not particularly difficult terrain to pass through either. So, I mean, you know, there really is a great danger then of, you know, a conflagration, which could then, you know, draw in other European countries that have been systematically underinvesting in their defense for a long time. So that's why I think that what Trump said was very dangerous. because, yes, it could get the European countries, and I hope it will get them, to take their own defence more seriously, but it might just end up with nobody providing this security at all, in which case the temptation for Putin is quite serious.
Yes, I mean, there's a parallel here with the immigration problem that Europeans perceive coming from the south, largely from Africa, you know, Italy and Greece and these kinds of countries that are recipients of boats coming and so forth. And then they, and because of the way the Schengen rules apply and so forth, once those people are in Europe, they can move within Europe by and large. And those countries feel like they carry a disproportionate burden, and no one else seems to
step up.
Yeah, I mean, said that, Merkel did step up famously in 2015.
But the thing is, they do have
that had domestic political ramifications, which were very serious.
Oh, yeah, it did. I mean, I think, you know, I'm wandering a little bit out of my area of expertise here, but I think that really when we look at Trump and the rise of these kind of radical right-wing populist demagogues, I think that immigration is a major part of it. I mean, it's a major, you know,
and it's a major part of him as well. Yes, you know, him, exactly. I mean, it's the big issue in the US.
Right. As a major
not Ukraine,
issue.
But South Americans coming up.
Yes,
know, the,
exactly.
The wall and so forth.
Yes, exactly. You know? And it was the major cause of Brexit, one of the major reasons for the rise of the AfD in Germany, the Front National in France, various different right-wing parties in Europe as well. You know, immigration is a big issue. And I mean, I guess for people like me and probably you as well, you know, I'm very pro-immigration, and those are my preferences. But I mean, the fact is, if we have really high levels of immigration, and that starts to put democracy in danger from these kind of radical right forces, you know, we may be compelled to say, look, we need to keep very tight control over this. Otherwise, it could overwhelm everything else that we care about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. It's a hard area to talk about because we're talking about human beings in desperate circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that always needs to be remembered. And it isn't remembered by a lot of people.
Yeah.
Donald Trump in recent days
animals,
has
yes,
been describing them as animals, as not actually people,
yes, exactly.
not humans.
Yes.
This is fascist rhetoric fundamentally and undisguisedly.
Absolutely, yes.
And so that is appalling. However, I remember John Howard used to say, and I think this is right, uncomfortable though it may be for some people to hear, he used to put it like this. He'd say, Australians are prepared to have very generous humanitarian intakes as long as they believe the government is in control of it.
Yes, that's true.
And so that word you used before, control, is really an important one.
Yeah.
Any serious nation state really is going to seek to control its borders.
Oh,
that's
absolutely.
Sort of a
exactly. Now, whether
issue.
We're doing it in a sufficiently humane manner is another question. I mean, I've seen, you know, sort of, you know, a lot of the debate about this. But yes, absolutely true. I mean, Australia has 25%, I believe, or close to 25% of our population is foreign born. That's way ahead of even the United States.
Yeah, and nearly half, Canada, very close to half, has a parent born overseas, at least one.
Right.
It's an astonishing level, really.
Yeah, it absolutely is. It absolutely
and a great
is.
Level. I mean, it's a great
it's
thing.
A great level,
lest I be misunderstood on that.
Yeah.
I celebrate this with
Oh, yeah, yeah, me
great
too. Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. But I mean, I think it is true that I think that, you know, the idea that of open borders, really, I mean, that's just not politically sustainable. And I think that the danger is, you know, no matter how much we may, some of us may want this on humanitarian grounds or economic grounds, the fact remains is that right now, the way that things are politically in developed democracies, it just isn't politically sustainable. And it could lead, if it goes too far, to the overthrow of the democratic system by radical right forces. So David Froom's former...
Well, that AfD point, so just before you go to that AfD point you made about Germany is can be tied really to that 2015...
Yes.
1.5 million, I think it was, Syrians mainly coming up through Europe into Germany. And Merkel at the time was very welcoming of them and spoke in very warm humanitarian terms. And it was... it felt like a high point for sort of civilization and humanity, but it fueled, it licensed
yes,
it a huge resentment, particularly in the eastern parts of Germany, the southeastern parts of Germany.
Oh, it did. I've even seen, even the Republic of Ireland, actually, in the last, in recent times, there's starting to be a major anti-immigration movement there as well, which is, I mean, quite historically unprecedented from their point of view. I mean, David Froom, I was going to mention, so he's a former speechwriter for George W. Bush. He's a never-Trump Republican, loathes Donald Trump. And his argument is, well, if Democrats don't control borders, fascists will. And that's...
Yeah, it's pretty economically put.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I think, I mean, I struggled against the idea at first, but I've pretty much come around to thinking that that's correct.
Yeah, I think, yeah, as I said, you know, that's a definitional matter for any nation state, really, to have essentially control of its territory.
Yes, exactly.
You can run very generous humanitarian programs with the support of the people.
Yeah.
If you are in fact running them, rather than having them run by someone else, by criminal elements or opportunist circumstances, whatever it is. But of course, as you say, you have to be, you have to have those strong humanitarian principles.
No, absolutely,
underpinning policy.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break there, I want to come back and just talk about that point you made earlier about expectations around what was going to be a spring offensive and eventually was a summer offensive, and then it wasn't quite as offensive as it needed to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Back in just a moment.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. Now I'm talking with Dr. Charles Miller from the School of Politics and International Relations. We're talking all kinds of different things. We're still going back on this Ukraine thing, Charles. The offensive last year, you mentioned earlier that it was widely heralded. This is the what was going to be a spring offensive. It ended up being delayed for a while, largely because of material problems, supply problems and so forth. And when it finally did happen, it still was probably under-resourced. And of course, we now know that, as you say, it can widely be regarded as having failed. Why this matters, though, in terms of expectations, I think is important, because the expectations that were created not just among, and in fact, perhaps not even principally among the Ukrainian people, but more importantly, among donor countries, is potentially where the problem is, because we now see a significant cooling of support for the war in Ukraine from several European countries, probably right across Europe, but certainly there have been polls in places like France, which has shown quite significant drops in public support for further aid or for increased aid to Ukraine. And of course, the political tide, as we've been touching on before, has turned in the US as well. We know, of course, success breeds a thousand fathers, or whatever the saying is. But failure, people start to lose faith, walk away, whatever. Now, Donald Trump's talked about, as Viktor Orban has been saying, the autocrat from Hungary has been saying after the two met at Mar-a-Lago a week or two ago, said that Trump had told him that he wouldn't spend a penny more in Ukraine.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do too. And this is consistent with what Trump's been saying. He said, for example, that he was going to end this war on day one, the first 24 hours, which basically means
a Russian victory.
Yeah, a Russian victory. We know he admires Vladimir Putin.
He does.
Putin has, for a long time in this war, been relying on Western resolve weakening. And that's why that expectation question mattered.
It does.
Right? Because, you know, it looked like you were going to continue on. Ukraine had made amazing progress, really, given that initially it was expected to be overwhelmed. And had made amazing progress. There was talk of pushing the Russians even back out of the Crimea, back to pre-2014 lines and so forth. And, of course, nothing like that has happened. And so now we see this lack of public resolve in a range of places, and Trump now saying that, you know, he's not interested in it.
Well, this is ultimately, I think, Putin's theory of victory. So in strategy, you talk about theory of victory, which is your concept for how you're going to actually win the war. And I remember back in the days when the Russians had been repulsed from in front of Kyiv, and the Ukrainians had mounted their very effective counteroffensive around Kharkiv. And there was this talk as if, you know, Ukrainian soldiers were supermen, they were highly motivated, the Russians had no motivation, they were going to lose. Yes. And we were all worried that the Russians would lose too badly. Remember that? That was a big kind of thing, you know, what if the Russians lose too badly? In the
too much humiliation is dangerous.
Yeah, exactly, right? And I have to say, and, you know, this can be backed up. So, I mean, I gave an interview, I think it was Sharon Grotch, and I think she's at the Sydney Morning Herald. And I said, look, I think the likeliest scenario for 2023 is stalemate. So I didn't think that the Ukrainian counteroffensive was going to succeed quite as spectacularly as many people thought it would. And I do think that that is the problem with these kind of expectations, you know, like thinking that it was going to be easy is that as soon as these expectations are dashed, immediately we start moving to the opposite extreme and thinking that it's going to be lost.
And how do we get out of it? Because we're certainly just enabling a stalemate.
Exactly. Is it really? And I see this, I mean, and to be honest, it makes me quite angry. I see this from quite a lot of people in the American right, this what I would call concern trolling. So, you know, is it really fair of us to keep giving weapons to the Ukrainians and just encouraging them to kill themselves against the Russians, you know,
like I said,
John Mearsheimer said this, various other American conservatives have seen this. It's kind of funny, by the way, just as an aside, that these people who were so over the top in favor of the invasion of Iraq have now all of a sudden turned into these hippie peaceniks.
Peaceniks,
yes, exactly. Yeah, I think this is pretty pathetic, really. But, you know, this is a kind of a train of thought which is going to gain if, you know, the Ukrainians are seen to be doing really badly in the war and potentially even losing. The danger is, I think, not that, let me put it this way, if the United States cuts off aid to Ukraine and the Europeans do not step up, then you're going to have a severe problem of weaponry and munitions for the Ukrainian military. At the same time, there's also a problem of recruitment because the life expectancy of Ukrainian infantrymen at the front is not great. And Ukrainian infantrymen at the front are dying in very high numbers, and it will be difficult to get. So right now they're talking about passing a conscription law to try and increase the size of the army. And it's very controversial because a lot of people don't. To, you know, they may want their country to be defended, but they don't necessarily want to be the one who's dying to do it. And if the weapon shortages are exacerbated, then this exacerbates this problem as well. So they don't have
enough. Not to mention morale.
Yeah, exactly. So they have a problem of a lack of men, a lack of equipment, and so on. So in those circumstances, the sort of the naive view is that then the war will just end because the Ukrainians will realize that they have to, you know, make peace and Putin will make peace and so on. But that's not what's going to happen. What happened then is that Putin scents blood and that he is on the way to a final victory. And he would be right in that sense because, you know, there would then be a serious danger that Putin would basically be able to break through the Ukrainian lines and take certainly a lot more of Ukraine than he currently has and possibly even the whole thing. Now, I know, again, there are some people who say, well, he wouldn't want to take the whole of Ukraine because the western part would be ungovernable. He wouldn't be able to be a counterinsurgency and so on. But, I mean, he tried to do that when he first invaded Ukraine in 2022. And there are other strategies that he could try, like putting in a puppet government, disarming the country. Then if the Ukrainians overthrow the puppet government, he can just easily invade again. And so there's all kinds of kind of nasty scenarios that could ensue if Western aid to Ukraine is not forthcoming. So whereas it used to be the case that we'd say, okay, well, we have to be careful not to give them too much aid because they'll humiliate the Russians too much, I think the danger now is we don't give them enough aid, so the Russians may end up going and taking the entire thing.
And absolutely right. And so there's this $60 billion US package that is held up in the Congress where it doesn't even look like being put to the House.
Yeah.
It is, you know, has a corrosive effect on morale in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
But presumably it also has significant domestic political implications in Ukraine as well because Zelensky's popularity is and support for him, which has been, you know, interstellar as a result of the plucky courage and success that he has led Ukraine to show through this invasion. that can't last forever. And if all the news is bad, then people start. I mean, we know he's replaced his his head of
Zeluzhny.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, I mean, yes, that's true. But I mean, I think if Zelensky was going to be voted out of office, he would probably be replaced by somebody who was equally as hawkish against Russia than himself. I mean, the Ukrainian people are not saying, "Let's give in and let Russia take over."
A poll that shows that there is an increasing number of people who are talking about trading territory for peace. Ukrainians. It sort of went from, I don't know, 7% to 13% or something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a possible. Well, I mean, it's possible that they might think that, but as a practical possibility, I'm not sure that that's true.
I agree with your prescription before. I mean, you do that and you've just got the Russians sitting on that line and ready to move further and take more territory.
Well, but I mean, the rival that I have heard that Zelensky is worried about is Zeluzhny. In fact, there is talk that that's why Zeluzhny was removed as the commander of the Ukrainian forces by Zelensky. And Zeluzhny Zeluzhny is not going to give in to the Russians. So I don't know if that is necessarily the issue that, you know, that Ukraine would go ahead and elect a government that was in favor of making serious concessions to the Russians. I think that the danger would actually be of a military collapse, that they may simply not have the material and they may not have the men to be able to hold the Russians off if they weren't being properly supported.
Well, I suppose all these things are related, though. It's a bit of a Rubik's Cube, because Zelensky has been the face of Ukrainian resolve and the chief salesperson of Ukraine's, the fundraiser and arms raiser for Ukraine internationally, and he's done that spectacularly. I mean,
he has done very, very well.
He's been a historical figure, and whether someone could do that as well, whether changing leaders, even if it's not logical, would just be one of those dysfunctional things that goes along with prolonged suffering, hardship.
Well, I mean, look, I am a little bit worried about the replacement of Zeluzhny because of Syrsky, his replacement. He is, as I understand, not very popular with a number of Ukrainian military people because he was too willing to engage in costly offensives against the Russians that wasted, in many people's views, a lot of lives. So I'm not sure that Syrsky is as good a choice as being the head of the Ukrainian military as Zeluzhny was. And I think that if, you know, Zelensky has basically taken Zeluzhny out of the picture for political reasons, that's not great. I mean, at the end of the day, look, I admire Zelensky a lot as well. But, you know, the cause of Ukraine maintaining its independence and resisting Russian aggression, for me, doesn't hinge on supporting Zelensky. There's plenty of other people in Ukrainian politics. In fact, when he became president of Ukraine, he was actually seen as being the more pro-Russian candidate. So there are plenty of other people who could take over at the helm and be the figurehead of Ukrainian resistance.
Yeah. So what do you think about this other idea that's been floating around of using this? I think it's about $330 billion worth of Russian assets held in overseas banks, which is frozen at the moment. And there's been this discussion, some calls for that money to be seized and then used to fund Ukraine's defense. A lot of people like the irony of that, of using Russian assets that have been stored overseas for safekeeping are being used to fund the campaign against Russian invasion.
Yeah.
And another, you know, I suppose less dramatic version of that is to use the dividends from that, the interest being earned from that, to at least fund Ukrainian aid.
I'm in favor of doing that.
The latter or the former?
The former. So using the Russian assets to fund the Ukrainian war effort. I mean, I'm not a sort of specialist in international financial law, so I can't tell you whether it would be open to some kind of legal challenge or not. I don't know. And if it were open to some kind of international legal challenge, I don't know what the consequences of that would be.
Well, I think the French finance minister, I think I'm right in saying that, someone who was speaking recently at the G7 meeting, might have been a G20 meeting, finance ministers it was in South America, said there is no legal basis for seizing those funds.
Okay.
But so what?
Well,
basis for the invasion either.
yes, exactly. So, I suppose the question is, there's no legal basis for seizing these funds, but would that actually make much of a difference? So the reason why a government would usually want to sort of uphold international law in the financial sphere would be because of the market reactions if it didn't. But I can't see why there would be a particularly strong market reaction in this case. So I don't think that it's the legal ramifications that are holding it up. I think more likely the reason why they're not doing it is because they want to keep some leverage in reserve to try and use it to pressure Russia so they can say to them, all right, if you agree to this peace deal, you give back this territory, you do X or Y or Z, then you can have your assets back. I think that's the major reason. But I mean, I think that right now with the situation being as it is and the danger of US aid being cut off, for example, and the uncertainty over whether Europe will be able to step up, I think that the risk of that is outweighed by the risk of Ukraine not getting enough aid right now. So I would say that that's a policy that they should engage in.
Yeah. Now, this podcast is called Democracy Sausage, and we haven't spoken about the Russian election. That's because there was no democracy.
Right. Exactly.
And probably not much sausage either, but certainly bugger all democracy in the in the process. What was it, 88% or 90% of the votes?
Yeah, I know. I put a massive bet on Vladimir Slutsky. I don't know where I'm there yet. No. Right.
I mean, obviously, this is a sham election.
Yeah,
I noticed absolutely. That a number of countries in the sort of 24 hours since the results been sort of declared, if only unofficially at this stage, I think. But I heard this morning China, India.
Mm.
India is meant to be our great friend.
Yeah,
but they just keep buddying up to us. China, Iran, North Korea, DPRK, all congratulating Vladimir Putin on this stunning endorsement from the people. I think they're missing a certain key aspect of what democracy is about. It's about choice.
Choice, yes.
You know, that,
exactly,
you have to make a choice. Yeah, that means having more than one option to choose from.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, they had four options. They had Slutsky. You know, they had a couple of other. They had the communist candidate. Then they had Party for the People or something like that. Yeah, they had a few. But obviously, I mean, it's completely rigged. I mean, there's no no question about that at all. But, well, you know, the question is, I suppose, like, why does Putin bother going through this?
Yeah,
charade,
but it is an interesting question, isn't it?
Why, it is interesting.
And this is, I've heard this being discussed in other places recently too. It's quite a common feature of autocratic regimes to still have elections.
Right. There's a whole literature in political science about elections under authoritarianism. It's not my field, so I won't go too much into it. I'm sure there's plenty of people that you could get on who'd be able to talk about this more than me. From what I understand from this literature, there's a few reasons why you might want to have elections as a dictator. First of all, one of the reasons why you might want to do it is because it does give you something of an idea of your levels of support, and particularly, you know, your trends in support over time and your trends in support geographically within the country. So you got 88% of the vote. You didn't get 100% of the vote. And in fact, it's good for him in some ways to not get 100% of the vote. There were people who voted for somebody else, because even though the election is highly rigged, it's not free and fair, there's still going to be some people who will not vote for him. And there will be some people who are brave enough not to vote for him. And that presumably gives him some kind of information about, I mean, based on the assumption that the people who are brave enough to vote for somebody else or not to vote at all are kind of like the tip of an iceberg of people who've voted for him but don't really support him and wouldn't support him in a competitive election. This can give him some idea about, first of all, like trends in his support. So how did he do in this election relative to a previous one? It can also give him an idea of where the pockets of opposition might be. So, I mean, if there's a particular part of Russia where he got, you know, only 75% of the vote as opposed to 88%, maybe that's an area that he wants to be concerned about.
Yeah, clamp down on.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the technical term for autocrats' concern. Clamp down.
Clamp down, yeah, exactly.
Crush.
Yeah. So I think that that's really what it is. I don't know whether it's really about legitimation, because I don't think anybody really takes it seriously.
Let me put another theory to you, and that is that, I mean, I accept what you're saying, but I want to sort of add to that rather than contradict it. It also has use for autocrats because it intimidates.
Yes.
I mean, basically
you're saying
I've got 88% of the population. Yes, there are some dissidents. And in fact, for this to work, you actually need dissident
voters.
Some of
them, yeah. Right.
You need a small number.
Yeah.
It lends the idea that there is choice.
Yeah.
But it reinforces dramatically the idea that 9 out of 10 Russians love this government, love the leader. Right.
Or at least are so scared of this government. Either they love this government or they're so scared of it that they're not even going to make even a minor gesture of protest.
But that's what you're up against if you're a dissident.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not sitting on 34% or 46%.
Right. Yeah.
You're sitting on
10%
or less.
It's called common knowledge. So basically, common knowledge is a term from game theory, which refers to, you know, what we think about what other people, or what we know about what other people know.
Yeah.
And so the idea is that everybody in Russia knows that Vladimir Putin got 88% of the vote. So, you know, what do you infer from this if you're a member of the opposition? Well, either 88%, you know, or rather 88% of the public are not prepared to make a minor gesture of opposition to Vladimir Putin, which means that there is some proportion of those people are fervent Putin supporters, some other people are scared. But in any event, that means that if you were to try and get rid of him, you could count on the support of at most 12% of the population, right? At most 12% of the population would do it. There's a book that I would highly recommend, and which was written by a guy that I worked for when I was a graduate student at Duke, is a Turkish-American economist called Timur Kuran. It's called Private Truths, Public Lies. And it is something about how public opinion works in autocracies. So essentially, you imagine that the entire population, there's some people who strongly support the dictator, some people who support the dictator pragmatically, dependent on how many other people they think support the dictator. And so the true distribution of public opinion in the dictatorship is never fully known. And if one day there is a sign or a spark, essentially, that shows that the dictator's support is lower than it was actually thought to be, that can collapse very quickly, like a house of cards. Mm. Because all of a sudden, you know, like, let's say you order people in terms of how much they support the dictatorship, right? So maybe person number 20 thinks that they will continue to support the dictatorship if and only if X number of people also support it. Well, then they see that actually X minus one people support it. So they change their mind. Then the next person, because they've seen the last person changing their mind, will change their mind too. And so it all falls like a house of cards really, really quickly.
I actually watched this happen. This is going to be a controversial analogy here, right? But I sort of watched this happen with Labour in 2010. Now, there was no autocracy. There was no autocracy, and I'm not making that point at all.
Yeah.
But what there is in a political party, and this is in all Democratic political parties when they're in government, is an assumption that the leader is there and that everyone supports the leader, within the party room.
Yeah.
Right? And I think what happened over a space of a few months, just watching it, and I was close to reporting it at the time, was that dissatisfaction amongst Labor MPs about the way Kevin Rudd was running the cabinet, running the government, and the way policies were drifting and so forth, particularly on climate change, started a bunch of people talking. And what seemed impossible and probably should have remained impossible, but nonetheless, what seemed impossible, the idea of taking down a leader who just won an election, hadn't even made it to the first attempt at re-election, suddenly became probable.
Inevitable.
Like it turned out there was this latent dissatisfaction that would only come out if people spoke to each other about it, which meant they had to be in Canberra for the most part, because rolling leaders only happens when Parliament's sitting and everyone's in the same place. And so a bunch of circumstances come together and you get this kind of, I don't like him either, I don't like him either kind of thing.
Exactly.
And suddenly there's a mass of people there and it looks possible, and that's what happened.
Well, this is, I mean, it can happen
sort
in democracies
of avalanche theory.
As well. Avalanche theory. Well, this is what can happen in democracies as well. But I mean, just a very interesting kind of data point in support of this theory of how, you know, these dynamics work. I went to Taiwan a few years ago and I saw a presentation by a guy called Gary King, who's like a sort of, you know, methods superhero in American political science. And he had been studying, him and his team, I mean, they have huge amounts of money, huge teams of people, have been studying what the Chinese government chooses to censor on in social media. And the interesting thing was they don't choose to censor expressions of opinion against the government by individual people. So saying, you know, I don't like Xi Jinping, or even more, I don't like what the local Communist Party boss has done, they're fine to leave that alone. What they do censor is people getting together. If people are getting together to protest or to even do things that are not particularly political and where they can talk to one another, even people who are getting together to protest in favor of the government's policies, that they will censor. Because what they're afraid of is people getting together and talking to each other and then finding out what they really think.
Yes.
They don't really care if people are saying like an isolated voice on the internet shouting into the void. That's not a threat to them. But combination is a threat to them. And so I find that, you know, incredibly interesting. And it is a further confirmation that that's how these kind of opinion dynamics work out a lot. There is a kind of an avalanche. And it does rely on people actually getting together and talking to one another and finding out what they really think about things.
Yeah, that's right. Because this is the great truth of these strong states, these strong leaders, these autocrats, is that they're actually very fragile often.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
Right? And they exist by force and they sell this idea that they are impregnable. Their leadership is so absolutely supported by the people.
Yes.
But history's shown that it doesn't take much and they can crumble. There are some exceptions to that, of course, DPRK being one.
Yeah.
But it's, yes, you get elections used for this and, you know, for legitimacy and for building respect and for, as you say, monitoring pockets of discontent and so forth.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
But essentially they are very, very fragile and they're very nervous and paranoid, always paranoid.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's critical when you've basically making people's opinions for them.
Yeah, well, of course, yeah.
Yes. Look, Charles, we've probably spoken long enough. Yeah. I look forward to doing so again in the near future.
Me
there's
too.
So much to talk about.
We'll be able to. We'll be able to do this again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for being on Democracy Sausage.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Democracy Sausage for this week. Talk to you again next week. Bye for now.